Thank you for joining us for today's Pediatric Insight. I'm Bruder Stapleton, Chair of the Child Health Advisory Council, and your host today. Our moderator is Dr. Arnie Strauss. Co-leading the discussion today is Dr. Catherine Edwards. We're also joined by Drs. Brent Polk, Richard Sugarman, and Danielle LaRocca-Arena. And now we continue with the second half of our conversation, recruitment and career development of pediatric physician scientists.
I think another thing that disturbs me, and I'm sure disturbs you, is just the that there are fewer of our young people that are wanting to do this, wanting to do the clinical investigation and laboratory investigation as well. And so I think that we have to, in our educational aspects, we have to really engender excitement about new knowledge and excitement about new perceptions. And I think it doesn't have to be a molecular perception. It can be a practice perception, or it can be an attitudinal perception. But I think that we as educators really have to get the excitement of new knowledge. And because I think if we don't, then there's going to be a further diminution in these critical people.
Again, I think there are many ways to do that. One of them that I enjoyed at Vanderbilt was that we set up a Saturday research get-together. I thought all the folks that were funded investigators, which was maybe 40 at the time, would come and you know, it would be a nice intimate gathering. Well, the whole damn faculty wanted to come because they want to be part of it in one way or another. They know how important it is. That's why many of us went into academic medicine. And I also think that that's where the recognition plays a big role. If they are recognized that the ED doc who recruits patients is just as important as the PI, or at least as recognized as a PI, then that makes it happen. And I just think that's a central role of a leader.
I really appreciate you bringing up that last point about the excitement that we need to engender in our early career faculty. I was wondering, you know, we hear so much now about the fear that our early career faculty have about the current funding climate. And I'm sure you in vaccine research know this all too well. Do y'all, I guess you and Dr. Strauss, do either of y'all have sort of perspective or words of wit? Like, how do we help people to maintain that long perspective that, you know, hopefully this too shall pass and that things will improve? I'm just curious how we, because we definitely hear from our early career investigators that anxiety about what it's going to look like even five years from now.
I'm at an infectious disease meeting, our largest ID week. So we've been spending a lot of time talking about this, and I don't know that any of us have the answer. I think we do have to be, as leaders, I think we have to be positive, even though, you know, there are a lot of challenges. I think that one of the things that has been a question is, you know, people say, well, you know, we talk about this, you know, and we write editorials and we're on various media things, but we're kind of echo chambers. People in Nashville don't read the New England Journal of Medicine, and they don't even read their newspapers. Are we talking to the right people? Do we need to get, you know, in social media, do we need to invest in other communication strategies? And I think, yes, we do. And I think we just have got to do something different, you know. But some of us said, well, maybe it's not about no kings, maybe it's about no doctors. And we, you know, we have a march and we talk about, again, I don't know the answer, and I'm not advocating any of these things, but I just think that we do have to be positive. If we're going to be a leader, we have to lead. And even though it's hard, we have to show something that's very positive. But how we ultimately get out of this, I don't think any of us really know.
This conversation brings me back to when I started as a junior faculty at Harlem Hospital and Columbia University. Rich Ruddy and I know each other well. He not only was a mentor, but he took care of my kids when I was at CHOP. I raise this issue because in the mid 80s and 90s, I know I'm dating myself. Yes, we had some federal funding from MCHB, but a lot of us did research just because we were compelled to do it, whether there was funding or not. And then when I did get savvy at grant writing, but there was a time when a lot of my publications did not come with funding, although I have to thank David Kornfeld. When I was a fellow, he got me institutional support, I guess, from one of the center grants. So I'm not naive to the need for funding, but I don't think the lack of funding should diminish our enthusiasm, because I have been through worse times. I hope I don't go through worse times now, but I've been through several bad times in academia as a Black woman who aspired to and was absolutely determined to go through an academic career. So I think that kind of enthusiasm comes, and I thank Rich because he was a wonderful, wonderful mentor and friend and colleague, that we can show that. We can display that.
I agree. I think we need to celebrate our successes, and there continue to be great successes. And we need to do it, as Kathy said, publicly, with the media, but also with families and parents and our colleagues, so that it becomes public. The success becomes public. And then we also need to show the negative consequences of not doing science well, and making sure that people understand what the risks that are developing are. So it is about being active publicly. I'd like to move on a little bit to the second question. Second question has to do with the support of a bench investigator. And I agree there's a little bit more sense about this among most people, but it doesn't always happen. And I think it's really crucial. So the key elements I listed here, protected time is absolutely essential, and God knows chairs tend not to do that because they don't understand that protected time means not seeing patients. And it's really crucial for an investigator to have that time. Lab space is crucial, but it's also crucial where it is and what the environment is. And I often felt the best way was to make sure the lab space was either adjacent to a mentor who was knowledgeable about the science, or within the mentor's laboratory, at least initially. Support for a lab technician is absolutely critical. Most people don't want to do this. They say, oh, they can do it all on their own. Well, baloney. You need to have someone who can be there all the time, every day, do the experiments when the faculty member is not available. So I think it really is crucial, and it's best to have a senior person who knows how to do the work. Some equipment that's unique or central to the subject matter is important, and a scientific oversight committee is also essential. It's critical, though, to have clear expectations. So the leader needs to say, this is what I expect you to do, and this is the timeline in which I expect you to do these things, write grants, write papers, etc. Communication is critical. The environment is critical. And the money is critical. And when you add this up, especially with all the salary time, it's $1 million to $1.5 million, just like it should be for a clinical investigator. So again, I'm happy to hear comments from those of you who have been through this, done this successfully or not, and if you have any additional thoughts. Dr. Polk, you've been through this a lot. I know you've recruited some successful folks. Do you have any comments?
I was just thinking about Kathy's admonition to engender excitement and thinking about these components. I have the privilege of running our PSTP program and just took all of our members out to dinner, and these are top of mind for those 10 individuals that, where are we going to get funding in the future? Where are we going to get our first jobs? What kinds of things, how do we, potential philanthropy and NIH grants, and how do we even frame NIH grants as the historical penultimate if this is going to change? I do think that time, and one of the things that I've been doing recently is changing from protected time, because many of our physician scientists are very committed to their patient experiences. I know you were, Arnie, and were a champion of doing better for patients by actually seeing patients as part of being a physician scientist. So I've changed my language around this to research time, clinical time, and other efforts. But I think the expectation within 3 years of getting funding, you're talking about a very expensive load, and it's going to vary across disciplines since we aren't all paid the same. But in that million and a half, maybe all the way up to 2 million with inflation. This is a terrific discussion. I hope you and Kathy will share your story with us.
Thank you, Brad. The last thing I'd like to talk about briefly, and Kathy, if you go to that slide about a scientific oversight committee, I think this is one of the issues that's already been raised and one which I also feel strongly about. So, Kathy.
Sure. So I think that a scientific advisory committee is critical. I think that it is essential for each new person. I think that the members should include the division leader, and it should also include the mentor of the person. It should also include, often if it's possible, a clinical research leader within the institution or someone that could also be another support person. I think it should always include a statistician, because we obviously have to make some interpretation of what we do. And I think that also an expert in the field of the study where the investigator is actually working. As I said before, we've had some luck with recruiting members from other institutions because of the virtual nature of some of our interactions. And also, as you know, to kind of bridge if there's a big component of another division that's being involved, that to include those people as well. I think there also must be a very clear understanding of what the mentor is going to do as well. And that certainly could mean or should mean regular meetings with agendas, with outlines. And also, as someone brought up a little bit before, I think there should be clarity on what parts of the work really will be the mentee's work and what parts will be the mentor's work. And I think that's really very, very critical as well. So the committee, yes, I think it should meet at least twice a year. I think that optimally a mentor-mentee meeting, I have mine every week, unless I'm out of town, but mostly I tried to have it every week with deliverables and clear guidelines as well. So I think that committee and that advisory group is really critical.
And I would just add that being on such a committee and interacting with a new faculty member, the recruited faculty member, indicates commitment and commitment to their career. And perhaps that's the most important component, is the encouragement that provides to a new recruit. Well, I think we've covered the questions, and I would just like to briefly summarize and emphasize that recruiting new faculty, investigators, physician scientists is expensive. But it requires a lot of attention to detail. It requires, I believe, a lot of interaction and communication between the leader and the recruit, and an understanding of what their research involves so that the support is both appropriate and targeted to their needs. Perhaps we didn't emphasize this enough, but the people are, in the end, the most important part. The mentor, the scientific oversight committee, the interactions will encourage what we all know is a very difficult career path. So I hope this discussion has been helpful to some of you. And obviously, as Kathy said, we encourage any questions or comments that you might have, and enjoyed interacting with you and having a conversation. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for today's discussion. The Child Health Advisory Council is comprised of a diverse group of emeritus deans, department chairs, division chiefs, and child health executives recognized for their leadership contributions in academic pediatrics and child health. The CHAC's impact is further bolstered by council specialty advisors who are active current national leaders in each of the subspecialties in pediatrics. Collectively, the 30 plus members of the CHAC bring unmatched wisdom and experience to career physicians' executive search and leadership development endeavors for its clients. If you have a question for our counsel or have a future topic suggestion, please connect with us at pediatricinsight.com.